Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. It is Saturday, July 17th, 2010. We had a very interesting week, if you consider life and death matters interesting. And, of course, at LaRouche Pack, we do. So this last week, Lyndon LaRouche issued a statement titled Endgame, The Time Is Now, in which he developed very specific timetable of July through mid-September as a period of reaching a physical boundary condition where within that period, and we don't know the exact time and date, but within that period, there's nothing in the way of a disintegration of the financial system. And we've seen that over the week. We've seen evidence of what's happening. With me in the studio today is Jeff Steinberg, an old friend, the regular contributor to the show. We just came from a meeting with Mr. LaRouche where we had a chance to discuss this. And I think what we will do is it's just going to be the two of us for the hour, and we're going to take the time to go through what are the developments that led to this forecast from Mr. LaRouche, and also on the other side, the fact that we have an alternative, which we had presented the week before by Mr. LaRouche, where he said there's an alternative set of governments in the wings, so to speak, that's coming together, which is looking to him for political and economic guidance. So, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
And let's just take up this question, the end game. What is the end game scenario?
Well, the end game scenario, interestingly, is a forecast that centers around President Barack Obama. Because the forecast that Mr. LaRouche presented is that barring a fundamental change in policy top down, beginning here in the United States, there will be an explosive breakdown of the entire international financial system sometime between the present moment and early to mid-September of this year. And so the premise there is that unless President Obama is removed from office before that September boundary condition, then there is no hope of the kind of policy change in the United States that would prompt him to make a radically different forecast. Let's say between now and the beginning of September, there is a sane reaction among both the American people and sufficient people within the governing institutions that they conclude that LaRouche is right, that the center of the problem is President Obama himself, and that Obama has to be removed from office, probably in a process very similar to what happened with Richard Nixon. Remember, Nixon was facing the threat of an impeachment trial in the Senate, and a group of leading Republicans at that time went to him and said, "Mr. President, you will be convicted in the Senate, you will be impeached, and the better course of action for you and the country is to leave now." It was all perfectly within the framework of the Constitution. Nixon left office. A certain real constitutional crisis was averted, at least for the time being. And in the context of that, Nixon actually, ironically, went on to make some handful of useful contributions to American foreign policy later. But he had to be removed then.
But Jeff, one of the arguments that you get when you talk to people in the political institutions is that there was a different time then, that you actually had people in the Republican Party and from the broader institutions who had the guts to stand up and go in and see Nixon and tell him that, just as you had people like Clark Clifford and others who told Lyndon Johnson back in 1968 that he had to leave. Are there networks around the president that could do that? Because we know it's not going to come from Emanuel or Jarrett or Axelrod.
The the problem I worry about is not whether or not there are people who are prepared to do it. The thing I worry about is that their calendar is off, that their watch is not set to the real world time.
That's why LaRouche said the time is now.
Exactly, because there are people already who are talking with the circles around Obama, who are talking with the Clinton group in the Democratic Party, who are talking with people in the military, in the diplomatic corps, and they're looking at a catastrophic defeat for the Democrats in the November elections, and that being the time frame where it's easier and more opportune to make a move on Obama. What LaRouche is saying is that the current collapse phase of the international financial and monetary system and the physical economy of this planet is such that we don't have the luxury of waiting around until November. It is a very, very high-risk proposition that we're going to still have a functioning economy and a functioning United States comes November. You just look at the elements of the picture. Europe is going through a sovereign debt crisis that cannot be solved without a bankruptcy reorganization of the kind that can only come with a Glass-Steagall reorganization, starting in the United States. There's no history or reference point for a Glass-Steagall-type bankruptcy reorganization in Europe. But if it happens here in the United States, Germany, France, Italy, you could envision countries making the move once they see the United States breaking from this Anglo-American, what they call the Washington Consensus.
And we're seeing some discussion of that sort from the, particularly in Germany, in France, Italy, even in China, you have certain networks that are talking about it. But Lyndon LaRouche has been explicit. It has to happen here first.
Right.
Is that because of the predominant or the preeminent nature of the U.S. economy in the world, or is it the American system that
It's because of the American system. We have a constitution that practically demands that these kinds of major reforms be instituted as the only way to respond to this crisis in a manner that conforms to the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution. The other aspect of it is that the United States is a leading power. The dollar is the world reserve currency. And so for all of those combined factors, it has to happen here. Plus, also, the British have a vice grip over the presidency right now, so long as Obama is in office. Now, the other aspect of the picture as to why the July to September conjuncture and also why a major political breakout change is conceivable in this very narrow time window is that as of the 1st of July, when the new fiscal year began in 46 out of 50 states, we entered a new phase of the breakdown crisis, and it's a phase that practically every household, at least in the lower 80% income brackets in every part of the country, is living through.
Well, Jeff, I want to come back to that, but okay. I think just for the sake of getting at the story, there are two things that we should take up at the top. One is to continue on the economic financial boundary conditions and then look at the political considerations. And then, of course, both of them are shaped by the breakdown of the state and local governments and also, of course, the effect of Lyndon LaRouche's statement that he's available for a government on the wings and the effect of the three LaRouche candidates in the race as a spearhead of a national movement. So let's just – you mentioned the situation in Europe where we saw this week the announcement that the bailout was successful, the situation is stabilized. They neglected to say the bailout was paid back because there was another bailout.
Right, exactly.
What we're actually seeing, it looks as though Spain and Portugal are falling into the same situation as Greece. There's nothing that's resolved. What can you add to that in terms of the picture there?
Well, there was a presumption that Germany and Germany backed up by the Fed here in the United States would be the checkbook of last resort, the hyperinflationary bailout of this unpayable debt, which happens to be, for the moment, concentrated in the so-called PIGS, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. We're talking here trillions and trillions of dollars in debt that at one point had been private sector debt, real estate bubble, things like that. But remember, in 2008, both in the United States and Europe, taxpayers through their governments intervened to basically bail out that private sector debt. So in effect, private debt became sovereign debt. And now you've got a sovereign debt crisis everywhere in Europe.
And by private sector, that includes bank debt.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the banks were the ones who were buying and selling these worthless assets and keeping them on their books and using it for leverage and so on.
It was gambling debt that was highly leveraged, that had no connection to the real world, that was bailed out by central bank policy, by consensus among all of the major world central banks, including the U.S. Fed. So,
and I saw the figure that I think Trichet, in fact, was the one who said they're going to need $5 trillion by 2012 to bail out the government and the private banking debt in Europe.
Right.
So,
but that's a massive understatement of the size of it. In this paper that you mentioned by Mr. LaRouche, the Endgame paper that was released at the beginning of this week, and I think it's now circulating in five or six languages, he made a very simple point that on a global scale, we've entered a phase of hyperinflation worse than we saw in Weimar Germany in the fall of 1923, so that you've got massive amounts of monetary emissions coming out of the central banks. But none of that is going to productive activity. It's going to bailing out gambling debts and is creating a hyperinflationary blowout at the same time that there is a collapse of credit for real economic activity.
Well, if you're creating new money to pay bad debt, even any gambler will tell you that it's not a good idea to pay off your bookie by borrowing from another bookie, which is essentially what they're doing.
Exactly.
Now, in the statement from Mr. LaRouche on Endgame is available in a PDF leaflet form on the LaRouche Pack website. And if you're listening to this program and you want to see the nation survive, print it, produce copies, and get it around. This really is a life and death question. Mr. LaRouche's forecasts have been accurate time after time after time. And this is another one of these moments where it's going to be on the back of the American people to either take this initiative and change it, or you're going to have the weight of this collapse come down on you. Now, in terms of the United States, this week the big news politically was the so-called victory of the president with his financial reform, the Dodd-Frank bill, which from even people who support it, they acknowledge that it allows the continuation of bailouts of the too-big-to-fail banks, which means they're not doing anything to throw out the garbage or the bad debt. Barney Frank and Obama explicitly intervened to keep a Glass-Steagall out. The Franklin Roosevelt-style regulations that would have cleaned up the bad debt and separated commercial and investment banks. There was no action to limit derivative speculative gambling. So the situation in the United States is still not only far from unresolved, but completely unresolved in terms of the banking crisis.
Well, you know, the president has a jobs program, and the jobs program was that the financial so-called reform bill that just passed and which he'll sign sometime very soon gives the banks added authorization to even expand their purely leveraged speculative derivatives activities, credit default swaps, mortgage-backed securities, you name it.
And some of these banks are, Wall Street firms are rehiring because they're going back into the junk debt market.
Exactly. There were cocaine parties and champagne parties all over Wall Street when the Senate passed the bill because they've been given an absolute free pass. In 2008, what Geithner orchestrated as the so-called saving of the system was an even further consolidation of the big six banks. It used to be there were 10 or 12 too big to fail banks. Well, they morphed them together into six banks that are now far too big to fail, meaning that there is a firm commitment that taxpayers' money is going to come in to bail them out again. In fact, the reason that there is no money going to the states for unemployment, for COBRA, for teacher salaries, for any of this, is because the federal government is in a hyperinflationary debt bubble to bail out Wall Street and, by extension, to bail out the entire British imperial financier system globally.
The Inner Alpha Group and so on. So,
exactly.
So what Mr. LaRouche is essentially saying in terms of the global economy is that the crisis that exploded, in, as he forecast in July 2007, is in a worse situation today because the debt has been consolidated and the government through the Federal Reserve is providing a free flow of money to keep these banks going. Meanwhile, that financial parasitical bubble is sitting on top of a continuing shrinking physical economy. So he's saying we're at a point where subjectively this could blow at any point. We're over the cliff. The question is, when does Wile E. Coyote realize he's over the cliff?
Right. Well, see, that gets us to the second aspect of Mr. LaRouche's forecast embedded in this endgame statement. Go back to April 11th, 2009, and Mr. LaRouche did an international webcast in which he said that Barack Obama is like the Emperor Nero. He is a total narcissist, and that psychological factor in the past several weeks has passed over from the Nero phase to literally a Hitler in the bunker, complete disconnect from reality. Remember, what was it that drove Hitler to commit suicide in the bunker under Berlin? He was firing off orders to his generals to mobilize and deploy divisions of the German army that had been defeated weeks and months earlier.
And also, I think, to burn down Berlin.
Exactly. And so he was in a delusional state, completely disconnected from reality of what's going on around him. And that is the shift that's also occurred in Obama's state of mind over the period of the last several weeks or so. And it's indicative of a number of things. You get this intensifying collapse of the real economy in the United States at the same time that the hyperinflationary debt bubble is mounting. And people all over the country are going through the hell of worrying whether or not their local firehouse is going to be able to respond when their neighbor's house is on fire, or that local police will be able to deal with the scourge of drugs and weapons and gang activity. So the economy in which the vast majority of Americans are living and suffering is one thing, and Obama is off in a total fantasy land claiming that he has driven the recovery from the Bush Depression and that job creation is on the rise. They issued a report on Wednesday saying that the stimulus bill has created millions and millions of jobs. It's in a different universe. It's a complete disconnect from reality. And every time there is any kind of imposition of reality on this bubble world that he's living in, we know from people in and around the White House that he goes absolutely psycho. So the image of Hitler in the bunker is the appropriate image, and that should be a very clear indication of why it is that this country and the world are doomed if Obama stays in office past that September 2010 time frame.
Okay, you're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg, EIR editor, Executive Intelligence Review editor, longtime activist and leader of the Lyndon LaRouche movement. We're discussing the latest forecast from Lyndon LaRouche, which is up on the LaRouche Pack website. It's titled Endgame. We'd like to take any of your questions via email. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Jeff, to go back to the political component, there are two things I'd like to discuss. You mentioned one of them, state and local governments. This is where we're beginning to pick up in the field, the Rachel Brown campaign, Keisha Rogers campaign, Summer Shields campaign, and just the organizing done by LaRouche PAC organizers. We're finding cities that are laying off police and firemen that risk lives immediately. In the city of Oakland, 80 police were laid off, and the department said, if you lay off these police, there are a number of crimes which will no longer be investigated, including robbery, including breaking and entering. So, you know, unless you're in the midst of a murder, you're not going to get police showing up. So that's something that hits at home. But at the same time that we're seeing this kind of recognition of the crisis, you had the obscene spectacle of the National Governors Association getting pounded over the head at their meeting in Boston by these two, you have to call them Gauleiters, you know, Nazi enforcers, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, who head up the Deficit Reduction Committee, who told the governors were there pleading, saying, can't we get some funds for education, for health care? One of them said, our job is to bring home the bacon. And Simpson said, there is no bacon, the pig is dead. And Bowles said, there's going to be no money for 10 years. What does that do, given that there's a ferment in the population, and we can go through the poll numbers if you like, how is it that governors can sit there then and listen to this kind of bullying from these two operatives of the City of London banks?
A lot of these guys have been brainwashed. Number one, they think that somehow or other they have to at least pay lip service to the need for austerity. And this is completely insane. This is British economics to the T. Really, it's British economics as practiced by Jalmar Schacht, who was a British liberal agent, but who was German and who was Adolf Hitler's finance minister, was a leader of the Bank for International Settlements, and was the architect of what ultimately became the concentration camp genocide.
So this is where you get the line from governors. They say, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem, and therefore we have to cut spending, even if it means people's lives.
Right. Now, you got to look at this thing from two broader levels. The proposals coming out of what's being called the cat food or dog food commission, because if the austerity measures that they are expected to propose are actually implemented, then you will wipe out the entire remainder of the Franklin Roosevelt New Deal social safety net programs, Social Security, and then, of course, the latter follow-on programs, Medicare, Medicaid. They'll be wiped out, and senior citizens will be back eating cat food and dog food in order to survive, as was the situation for many before Roosevelt came in and transformed the country by going back to Hamiltonian American system policies. So the commission itself has already been told what the final outcome of their, quote, study and recommendations is going to be. It was published, and you can find it on the website of the International Monetary Fund. There was an IMF conditionalities team that was in the United States studying how to impose murderous austerity on the United States the way that the IMF destroyed the Third World during the 1990s. And that report came out, and what was said by Bowles and Simpson up in Boston at the governor's conference was a script that was written and available for anybody to read right on the IMF site. But beyond even that, the policy, the Schachtian economic policies that are being pushed now on a global scale are only understandable from the standpoint that the leading figures within the British oligarchy and the British monarchy, talking about Prince Philip, founder of the World Wildlife Fund. The policy is reduce world population from the current level of 6.7, 6.8 billion people and growing down to below 2 billion people, and to do it within one or two generations. That's mass genocide.
Now, this is where we get to the other initiative taken this last week by Lyndon LaRouche, where he tasked the basement team, the young people doing advanced scientific work, who've gone through Kepler, Gauss, Riemann. They're looking at relativistic economics, you might say, of Planck and Einstein. He's given them an assignment to put together a tensor analysis, that is to look at this question of what happens when you sustain payments to the mass of financial aggregates and funny money, keep that going at the expense of the physical economy, and to demonstrate what he means by a boundary condition for a breakdown. And that, as I understand it from the discussions the last couple of days, is behind his forecast. But he wants it to be animated and put up on the website. So the average person who is eating cat food and feeling the pressure from foreclosure, job loss, can actually see that this is the reality.
Exactly. One of the things that Lynn discussed with us over the course of this week is that if you're thinking about physical economic processes, you've got to think of it in terms of 100-year periods of time, because when you're thinking about the kind of large-scale infrastructure that forms the basis for any either successful or failed economy, then you're thinking about a 100-year period. For example, we're talking about a massive federal government capital investment to build 46,000 miles of electrified high-speed rail and maglev, to bring a 21st century mass transit system back to the United States. We had this kind of capability by those technological standards back in the beginning decades of the 20th century. We've wiped it out. So if you think about the time it takes to build up these large-scale infrastructure projects, and then the shelf life before you have to move in and replace and modernize and upgrade, you're looking at a span of 100 years. What Mr. LaRouche has emphasized repeatedly is that from the moment of the death of Franklin Roosevelt in April of 1945, there has been no net real physical economic growth in the United States since that time. Now, that happens to be 65 years. So we are.
And you know, most Americans, if you tell them that, their initial reaction is, well, but I have an iPad, an iPhone, three computers, a car that's run by computers.
And $400,000 in debt, all of my very own.
That's the point. And then you look at the problem of getting clean water. You look at the water problems, Chicago water mains breaking, Boston breaking, breakdowns in transportation. So there's an illusion,
right,
that people have. And this is what the work in the basement is designed to get at.
Right.
And what Mr. LaRouche said today, which was quite provocative, and I did an interview with him yesterday that's available on the LaRouche Pack TV called Tensors, Counterpoint, and Creativity, is that when you deal with economics, physical economics is largely the question of the development of the mind.
Right.
And that's the difference, the starting point of a human economy, as opposed to a sexual fantasy, which is basically the Tim Geithner, Larry Summers approach to economics.
Right, exactly. The fact of the matter is that we are now at a point where well over 80% of the American people have angrily repudiated Barack Obama. They voted for him after the Democratic Party, on orders from London and Wall Street and the Boston Vault, ran a vicious campaign to deny Hillary Clinton the nomination. They picked up Obama because he was their asset for a very long time, and they had the added factor of knowing that he was thoroughly unqualified to be president. And they knew that simply by surrounding him with equally unqualified and evil people, that they wouldn't have to micromanage things. He would destroy the United States almost single-handedly in a stunningly short period of time.
Well, and there are two points here that come up. What does that say about the Democratic Party, which was an active participant in this? And not all Democrats. A lot of Democrats opposed this, but they didn't oppose it effectively. And also the Congress. So when we're looking at this breakdown, we're actually taking into consideration that these institutions have been corrupted.
Right.
But what's the point of corruption? Most people think it's because of money. What do you think?
No, it's not money. Frankly, the greatest source of corruption is that people have allowed themselves to abandon that which is human. Namely, there is a absolute correlation between human creativity and morality. And what's happened in the broader culture is that that has been destroyed. You know, Lynn talks all the time about the baby boomer culture. And again, if you look at the long wave, he was discussing this with us earlier today, his generation came back from World War II. They had gone to war under Roosevelt. They came back moralized by the victory against Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese, but they came back to a United States under Harry Truman, a United States that had been aligned with Churchill and the British, which was exactly the opposite of what Roosevelt was intending for the post-war world. He was going to basically complete the defeat of fascism by eliminating colonialism and imperialism from the planet. So people came back to a United States dominated by a little man under the control of Churchill. The little man was Harry Truman. We were suddenly in a Cold War. We were in a national security state. We were in a situation where the industrial capacity that Roosevelt had built up was taken down. Roosevelt wanted to use the war mobilization capacity to retool for civilian infrastructure requirements in order to actually turn the United States into the great factory for the rest of the world. What happened with the Marshall Plan and what MacArthur did in Japan was a pale thing compared to what Roosevelt intended. We decommissioned the great industrial mobilization of World War II. And so the Truman period was a turning point. People were terrified. And so when the baby boomers were born in the immediate aftermath of World War II, they were born into a culture that was already making compromises with the great accomplishments that had been realized under Roosevelt, especially the victory in the war.
But you had some elements that continued. For example, the space program is one of the singularities.
Sure. Exactly.
And, of course, you and I grew up as people from that baby boom generation, inspired by Kennedy, and then there were the series of shocks starting with his assassination, the assassination of his brother, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, the Vietnam War, the Nixon
exactly.
presidency. And as a result, what Lyndon LaRouche is saying is the generation literally went crazy.
Exactly. Gave up on the moral mission. Gave up on any real purpose in life. Became addicted to existentialism. Adapted to a British liberal outlook that said it's all about the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, although some people got the two a little bit confused along the way, you know, Barney Frank and things like that.
The Marquis de Sade principle.
Exactly right. Yeah, one man's pleasure is another man's pain and vice versa.
So when you look at this then, to say that we've had from 1945 to the present was a period of time where we've gone through, at least at the beginning, the coexistence of two different, not economic systems, but two different approaches, but it was still under a financial system dominated by monetary
right.
policy, by money.
Right.
So what Mr. LaRouche has said is that we've reached the end, the absolute end of that system, and now we have to move to a new system. Now, you and I were talking earlier because you, we both talked to people who were involved in politics and the institutions. You were reporting that there was a shift, a palpable shift in maybe even in the last week since Mr. LaRouche put out this statement. What are you picking up on that, Jeff?
The irony is that from a certain standpoint, since he was inaugurated as president, Barack Obama has successfully pushed through Congress three major pieces of legislation, a nearly $1 trillion stimulus package, which did nothing whatsoever to create jobs. It was, you know, to the extent anything useful came out of it, there was a certain amount of welfare money that went to the states. But as a stimulus to rebuild or revive the economy, it did absolutely zilch. Then he got through a health care bill, which was modeled on Hitler's 1939 to 1941 program of euthanasia. And then now in this past week, he got through a so-called financial reform bill that is exactly to Wall Street specifications, that the too-big-to-fail policy has been now written in stone. The too-big-to-fail banks will be bailed out, all six of them, with taxpayers' money, and now it's going to literally come out of the blood and the hide of the American people. So three great victories, yet Obama is the most unpopular president at this point in his presidency, probably of any president in the history of the United States. There's a groundswell to get this guy the hell out of office among probably upwards of 85% of the American people. So his success can actually be measured in the acceleration of the total destruction of the United States. That message is now impossible to avoid. Nobody who is involved in any way whatsoever in politics in the United States can avoid that reality. And so as Lynn made his forecast and talked about the July to September period as an absolute turning point and said in no uncertain terms that Obama has to be removed from office through constitutional legal means, no assassination, totally protect the guy, including protect him against himself. He has a narcissist streak that when it blows, could be suicidal. So we've got to get this guy safely out of office, put him in a situation where he is protected, where nothing happens to him, but he is not serving as president. Joe Biden, under the succession, would come in. He's at least in his outlook an American. He's an experienced politician. He will turn to
more
advisors.
More importantly, if the surge in unpopularity against this president succeeds in ousting him, Joe Biden is smart enough to behave himself and
yes,
pay attention to what the American people are saying.
Right.
So we're back to this question then of a willful intervention by the American people, because my view is that the congressmen who voted in these three pieces of legislation, who have tolerated the president, who talk behind his back against him, but they don't have, at least even with the incumbents that have lost, there's not the courage among the enough of the Democratic Party leadership to oust him. So this, I guess, brings us to what activities the American people take.
Right. Well, you know, we saw the beginning last August of a mass strike process. It has not ended. It has intensified. It's accelerated. And simply because this time when Congress went home for the 4th of July recess, very, very few people were suicidal enough to actually hold public town hall meetings and bear the wrath of their constituents. That does not mean that the anger has subsided. It's become deeper. It's become better informed in terms of the actual magnitude of the crisis. And what we've found in the three LaRouche flagship campaigns in Boston, in Texas, and in California, and in the general organizing all over the country, is a level of seriousness where people are not just simply venting their anger. They're looking for answers. They're looking for solutions. And increasingly, because of the persistence of LaRouche's campaign to reinstate Glass-Steagall as part of a larger economic recovery perspective rooted in the constitutional credit system that's unique to the United States, people are getting the idea that there's leadership out there that knows what to do. And so, therefore, they have a more well-defined role to play in this process. They've got to be the drivers. They've got to be the pitchfork brigades that basically scare the bejesus out of these members of Congress. But beyond that, remember, the United States is a presidential system. Our Constitution is a presidential system in which Congress has a certain partnership role to play with the executive branch. A great deal of it involves checks and balances. And we know that throughout our history, during periods of grave crisis, like the one we're going through now, and this is probably the gravest crisis in the history of our republic, it's always been from the presidency that you've got the ability to move quickly and to put forward the policies that Congress can then act on. And so the issue of Obama is an existential issue for the survival of the United States. Get rid of Obama and you will remoralize the institution of the presidency, which has been crippled by the fact that you've got an occupant in the Oval Office who is, in fact, an enemy of the interests of the United States.
And a lot of Americans know that and have come or are coming to see that.
Right.
We see from the organizing, for example, today there's a conference in Boston held by the Rachel Brown for Congress campaign on the two Massachusetts, which takes up this theme that Lyndon LaRouche developed, that you still have a Tory faction in Massachusetts. Barney Frank's an example of that. Scott Brown, the male model, you know, who got elected to the seat formerly held by Senator Ted Kennedy, and who's now a turncoat, who's now siding with Barney Frank, much to the dismay of the Tea Party people and others who voted him in, the independents and Democrats who wanted to change the policy. So that's one Massachusetts. The other Massachusetts is the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the Winthrops, the Mathers, the LaRouche family. It's the Massachusetts of Rachel Brown, of Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy. So these are the questions that have to be fought out now. But it's a very short period of time. The part of the question is, can the American people respond to the crisis not just with a knee-jerk reaction like electing a Scott Brown or a Rand Paul, but actually come in from the top to make sure that the government in the wings that LaRouche represents can be brought in? Now, to what extent, Jeff, do you think there's a growing understanding of some of the institutional layers that you're talking to that you can't just let chaos take over? You can't just wait till November. There has to be some preemptive action around Obama and with Lynn.
Well, you know, I think that, I think we passed into a new situation as of the beginning of July, where increasingly people are being forced to acknowledge that not only is LaRouche right about the general characterization of the crisis, but that he may be the only person in the real world in terms of the appropriate time frame for dealing with these problems. And so, you know, this is one of these moments in history where we have the opportunity to avoid a tragedy, and where it's incumbent on the American people and on those within the governing institutions of this country to overcome their cowardice, to overcome their impulse to want to second-guess everything. The biggest problem with boomer culture which is the dominant culture. I mean, the boomer generation is the generation that is right now dominant in all of the governing institutions of the country, whether it's governmental, economic, financial, cultural. The tendency is to have this existential flaw and fear to be scientific about reality and to say it's not an either-or proposition that Obama has to go. It's not an either-or proposition that we could lose everything in a matter of weeks or months if we don't start the process now of turning things around. Get rid of Obama, and then the issue of Glass-Steagall is immediately on the table. The issue of LaRouche's approach to job creation through capital budgeting for massive infrastructure projects. That's the way you revive the private sector. You don't give tax credits to small business and think that individual small businesses left to their own devices are going to flourish. That's insane. Every economy that has thrived and prospered in history has done so because there has been massive government-sponsored capital investment in infrastructure. And the bill of material for that infrastructure is what drives the private sector. And you create an economy that's improving its productivity with greater energy flux densities, with scientific innovation, and that's what we need to do now.
Now, there was this very significant conference that took place on April 29th where Lyndon LaRouche addressed a series of leaders and officials. The transcript of that is up on the website. I presume between April 29th and the present, the people who are participants in that have also seen the unfolding of the situation, have also been apprised of Mr. LaRouche's forecast this last week. So I'm assuming that we're not just talking about a U.S. phenomena, but that we are looking at the possibility for this four powers agreement coming into blossoming into full flower. So it's not just a question. I mean, it does have to be fought out in the United States, but we know, I assume, Jeff, don't we, that we would have that sympathetic response from these other countries and leaders of Russia, China, and India.
The April 29th meeting, Harley, that you're referring to was a dialogue with Lyndon LaRouche. And among the participants in that were a number of leading and very competent and growing in competence American economists. There were also a number of leading diplomats from the four powers countries, among others, who were participants in that event. And I think you'll see that when you read the transcript, that it was a discussion about a whole new set of strategic alliances centered around the four powers, the United States, Russia, China, and India. This is not an exclusive club of some kind, but the idea is if you're going to defeat the power of the British Empire, which is centered in the international financial oligarchy, the offshore financial centers, you need the most powerful sovereign nation states coming together in what John Quincy Adams described as a community of principle among perfectly sovereign nation states. So the United States, Russia, China, India, each for their own obvious reasons, have to form the core of it. The discussion on April 29th very much centered around the Russia situation. And that was very lawful because from a historical standpoint, the U.S.-Russia partnership has been an anchor for this global cooperative system since the time of the American Revolution when Catherine the Great helped organize the League for Armed Neutrality to the period of the Civil War when Tsar Alexander II sent the Russian Navy and put it at the disposal of President Lincoln. Where it was a self-conscious war against the British Empire. It was the same arrangement between Roosevelt and Stalin during World War II. They knew that Churchill had been instrumental in putting Hitler and Mussolini into power and only switched sides when Britain's survival as an empire was jeopardized by their Frankenstein monsters. So these things are crucial because the whole idea of winning this Glass-Steagall fight in the United States and going back to our historical fundamental principles is that it was always an international Republican revolution that was the objective of those people who founded a republic on these shores to get away from the power of European oligarchy.
Well, and Jeff, that brings me to the final topic we have to take up. We have just under 10 minutes, and I'd like to remind people you're listening to The LaRouche Show. Next week, by the way, I'll be interviewing the presidential candidate of the LaRouche movement in France, Jacques Cheminade, who is a senior statesman in France who has, like LaRouche, made a series of forecasts. He's supported the LaRouche forecast, and Jacques is in a very strong position right now, as it looks as though instead of 2012, the election may be sooner because President Sarkozy, who's been functioning as a British puppet, could be dumped. So next week, next Saturday, will be Jacques Cheminade. Now, I bring this up because after we've looked at this picture, the forecast from LaRouche of the collapse of the economy as we reach a break point, the opposition to Obama in the United States and globally, and that this is a global fight against a British imperial system, the British Empire is not without damage that they can do to prevent the four powers from coming in. And we were just talking about this earlier, the Middle East situation, the Iran question, the Israel-Palestinian situation, Pakistan, North Korea. There are a number of these situations that have been set to blow, and where you have the thing in common is either they were set in place originally by the British in the Middle East, the Sykes-Picot, the Afghan situation goes back to the Great Game in the 19th century, and then Brzezinski and the Carter administration. But they still exist as real flashpoints. So where do we stand in these situations?
Well, they are really at an edge. Just in the past 48 hours, there is a new surge for a direct attack on Iran. And this, contrary to some of the news accounts, is not primarily coming out of the military in the United States. It's coming from the president. It's coming from the White House. And it's not surprising that this has emerged in the aftermath of this disgusting display of ass-kissing that we saw between Obama and Netanyahu a little over 2 weeks ago.
When you say it's not coming from the military, to what extent was the McChrystal Rolling Stone interview and then him falling on his sword an indication from the military that they don't want to be held responsible for the failures of the Obama administration? Is there something that's being communicated from the military?
Well, what McChrystal did, first of all, he knew perfectly well what he was getting himself in for by giving an interview to Rolling Stone magazine. He didn't necessarily anticipate that the overwhelming focus that would be the pickup from the media would be on a bunch of jocular comments that were made. But McChrystal intended to deliver a message. The very war strategy that he himself was part the author of was failing. Number two, that the idea of Obama as commander-in-chief was a joke. You can't conduct a war of any substance, particularly a long war, when you don't have the commander-in-chief really playing the role of commander-in-chief. You had Holbrooke, Ambassador Eikenberry, Vice President Biden. You had all kinds of people getting in the way, and the military had the very distinct smell that this president would sell them down the pike in a heartbeat if it would help his reelection. And so the military began to get the sense that for purposes of his reelection campaign, Obama, who was completely disconnected, not even interested in understanding the dynamics of what was going on and why it is that a democratic republic can never fight a long war. And this is a war that's going into its 10th year already. For all of these reasons, the military concluded that they were going to get sandbagged. Mm-hmm. And so McChrystal reopened the policy fight with that interview. And it's an indication that there is widespread dissatisfaction bordering on hatred of Obama for his failure to serve as commander-in-chief. Same exact thing in the crisis in the Gulf of Mexico with the BP spill.
Now, is this resonating among these same political institutions, these off institutions of the president, the Congress that we've been talking about?
Emphatically.
So this is – it's clear then across the board on economic policy, on – policy, for example, protecting the country from an oil spill, the failure to deal with the British-run terrorism that's destabilizing the broader Middle East. On all these counts, there's a recognition that this administration is a menace to the survival of the United States.
As Shakespeare would have put it, there's something rotten in Denmark. So there's a recognition of it. And the point right now is that the only voice speaking with clarity on what's going on, what the solutions are, and what the time frame is for action is Lyndon LaRouche. And there are many, many people who would hold their noses and run in the other direction at the thought of having to publicly discuss the fact that LaRouche is putting some ideas out. Nonetheless, to even say that LaRouche has been systematically right in all of his forecasts, including this current one. But the reality of the crisis is forcing people to make some very fundamental decisions, especially people operating within the framework of the institution of the presidency, feeling the American people, reaching out and looking to them for some kind of leadership. And the only answer on the table right now is Obama's got to go. It's got to happen before September. Get him out of there, and the new policy options are there. The availability of quality people to fill the vacuum in terms of governance, it's there. But if you don't face the cold, hard reality that as long as Obama is there in the White House, replaying Hitler in the bunker, then this country and by extension the world doesn't stand a chance of avoiding the pitfalls of a dark age in which Prince Philip's dream of reducing the world population by 80% will be realized in the next few generations and will be crawling out of a hole 3-4 generations from now if we're lucky.
So what we can say is that these are the components of what Lyndon LaRouche has put forward as his forecast of an end game.
Right.
And the most important one is the reduction of the physical economic means to sustain a population, which is the precondition for chaos, dark age, and a war. So we're just a minute and a half or so to go. I mean, Jeff, you're an old hand at this. You've seen this situation. Is your sense that the mass strike, as you said earlier, it's not stopping? Do the American people have this connection to the historic legacy, in your mind, to rise up and take responsibility?
It's an impulse. You know, Winston Churchill once said begrudgingly that you have to hand it to the Americans. They always get it right after everything else has failed. So I like to think that we've gone through 65 years of everything that's failed, and now we're in this kind of existential moment. And, you know, I put the onus not only on the American people, at least the kind of a Gideon's army of leading grassroots citizen leaders among the American people to step forward. But I also look to those people who are part of the institution of the presidency, who are the current and former diplomats, military officers, intelligence officials, elected officials, who have a better and more privileged position to see exactly how desperate this situation is. And the question is, are you going to act effectively, in which case LaRouche has another forecast in his pocket?
Well, I'll give you the final word on this from LaRouche. I yesterday ended an interview with him saying, you're the perennial optimist. He said, I'm not an optimist. I'm just determined to win. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need, that determination to win. That's what you have to do. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern. I'll be interviewing Jacques Cheminade, candidate for president of France. Go on the LaRouche PAC website and get this leaflet and get it out. Your life depends on it. Thank you.